Blog Talk Radio.
Wonderful. All right, that was the wrong intro music. Hello, everyone. Today is Sunday, May the 22nd, recording live at the nation's capital. I am your host, the politically incorrect, sometimes plain incorrect, media mogul, Giovanni Russo. This is Populist Radio, Season 2. Guests for today include conservative speaker and host of the Did She Say That show on Breitbart podcast, the beautiful, the gun-toting, and loud Sunny Johnson. Hi, Sunny.
What's up?
Good to have you. I know that it kind of took long enough, but glad to have you on.
Here.
Yes. And president of Speakerman Media, Mr. Lee Speakerman. How are you, Lee?
Terrific, Ronnie. Great to be here.
Yes, glad to have you on. All right, and let's get started, folks. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump has proposed to end all gun-free zones in America, to which Madam Pantsuit stood atop her cankles and accused Donald Trump of trying to make classrooms and schools more dangerous, allowing guns in the school, in the classroom. She says the idea isn't just way out there, it's dangerous. Now, I'm going to read to you something that Sunny said on her podcast a few weeks ago about gun control. I asked, what would Sunny do if an intruder came into her home? Her response? First, when the intruder walks in the door, I point to my gun-free zone. And then when they pass my gun-free zone sign, I point to my violence-free sign. And then I point to my no-raping sign. And when they pass that, I blow their fucking head off. I mean, I think that pretty much sums up how I feel about gun control. Do you have anything else you'd like to add to that, Sunny?
No, that sounds like pretty much what I said. And all it is, I want to say, what Donald Trump said basically was that it was the school's right to decide whether or not they need armed security. And that's so now with that, that allows Hillary to say that that's what he wants. Donald Trump wants guns in every classroom. And that's just more of, I'm like, we're getting ready to witness the most brutal presidential campaign in the history of the United States. It's all going to be televised and run all over the internet. And it kind of reminds me of that thing in the Bible that says that everybody will be watching when the destruction of the world happens. And, like, it feels like this moment that everybody will be watching, and we're going to see these two Teflon Dons who have made it through life untouched, unscathed, go after each other like Godzilla and Mothra. And all we get to do is sit back and watch.
With popcorn.
With popcorn.
And some with guns, I guess. but, you know, I'll tell you what this to me typifies, what you just said about Hillary's reaction. And that is, you know, we always hear that Donald Trump goes over the top and exaggerates. But when she takes every position that he utters and mischaracterizes it or makes a ridiculous, over-the-top allegation about it, like we're going to have guns in every classroom, first of all, in an open carry states like Texas, where I am, children are not allowed to possess handguns, walk around with handguns. You know, the law still applies. A gun-free zone means that you cannot basically have armed security for our school children. That's crazy. Well, people that are trained and have the permits and have run the gauntlet that allows them to carry a gun cannot be permitted to do so. So that some building or some complex or some school is going to basically trump the law that the people have allowed to be enacted and the regulations, which are very strict about how that can be carried out. So, you know, my theory on gun-free zones is they're very dangerous, which Donald Trump has pointed out. But the other thing we're not looking at, and this so often happens in our public discourse, let's start with reality. The reality is we have almost as many guns in this country as we have people, hundreds of millions. And we can either... Let's say you don't like guns. Okay, let's take that position. Okay, you can either take a utopian position, which is we're going to find a way to get rid of guns, which would require a police state that would make the very ones who advocate gun control, the left, blanch. I mean, imagine if you could, you know, bust into people's homes to see if they have a gun. You know, while they're at it, let's see if they have anything on their computer that's inappropriate or perhaps terrorist. You know, let's check out their papers while we're at it and make sure they're not tied to terrorism. I mean, there's no end to it. So to carry out any kind of gun control would be a nightmare for the left as well as everybody else. So let's look at it the other way. The guns are there. They're not going anywhere. We have a Second Amendment, and even though Hillary will try her best, as Trump has said, to undermine it, it's still there, and the Heller decision means it's been reinforced by the Supreme Court. So why don't we have the ability to carry guns and are permitted to carry guns, either open or concealed, and aggressively push to have them trained for live shooter situations, and then if they meet that training or achieve that training, give them a form of deputize them. Give them the responsibility if they're in a situation where a shooter emerges that they are expected to deal with that shooter. You know,
and
we have
that is the solution too for the violence that is in the black community. You
yeah.
need grandmas trained in guns. You need young men to learn about guns from trained instructors instead of their 16-year-old cousins that give them a gun and tell them to point and shoot. This is why we have this problem now, because the left went so far thinking that they can take guns out of society instead of teaching proper gun control and gun safety. Most kids, most young black males especially, they get their first gun experience from someone who has no experience with guns. And that leads to not understanding and fully appreciating the consequences of your damn actions, which leads to someone stepping on your shoe and you thinking that that's a reason to pull out a gun and shoot them. So everything the left has tried to do with their gun control has taken away the ability to teach responsible gun ownership to the very people that need it the most, those who live in the inner cities under this abject violence where the weekly reporting is how many people have been shot or killed over the last weekend. If there's anything about Donald Trump is going to stick to his priorities, and his priorities do not include coming after your gun.
Right. And, you know, the thing is, if the NRA, instead of opposing background checks, which is ridiculous in my opinion, if instead of stuff like that, they push the idea of involving veterans groups, involving law enforcement, and this kind of training, if people are exposed to that, some, as you mentioned, kids in tough inner-city neighborhoods or, you know, be they parents in the suburbs or whatever, if they are exposed to that and trained and have exposure to law enforcement and exposure to people who know how to use guns responsibly and when not to use them, that's going to make them much more responsible. That's going to be passed on to people that they
that's
know.
True. Yeah,
it's
I mean,
also going to give. It's going to make them vested in the system. I mean, if you have concealed carry or if you have open carry, and you have a gun and you've had this training and you know that you are expected to help if there's a crisis, if you see a criminal come out with a gun and start shooting or threatening to shoot, and you know what to do, and you know you're expected to help with the situation, you're going to be much more responsible and more thoughtful and more committed to our system and our country, in my opinion.
But, Lee,
so I mean,
look at the elected
officials. Something that ought to be pushed.
Like, look in D.C. It doesn't matter the amount of crime or shootings that happen here. We still have a mayor that's she's openly admitted that she was against guns. They said that the rise in crime in this country is because of the cities of Baltimore, Chicago, and I think Detroit and D.C. And again, the mayor is still against it. I think that they said that the number of shootings has not really gone down over the years, but the ratio of people actually being hit versus just the gunfires or people being killed is gone down. So people are shooting nowadays, but they're not reaching any target.
Well, that's a good.
I mean, they're not using guns for what their intended purpose.
Well, you know, again, it comes down to the people, and I know it's trite to say guns don't kill, people do, but the biggest problem with our society is we're not dealing with and valuing the people, and especially the people in the neighborhoods that Sonny is alluding to, these tough neighborhoods in the inner cities, which, you know, are the creations of the white power structure after World War II. They didn't just happen by accident. So these cauldrons of violence and dysfunction and privation are not a priority in this country. And the irony is that Donald Trump is the guy back in the 80s. I mean, you can see YouTube videos of him saying, we've got to rebuild our inner cities. I mean, this is a guy that has actually talked about this stuff. Now, I don't know many other Republicans since Jack Kemp died that have been doing that.
And
so,
on top of that, I think that this is the period where Donald Trump is learning to be a conservative. I have never called him a conservative because I didn't think he was. But in this time period, you are watching him become a conservative. And
as he becomes one,
I mean, saying hopefully that he actually does the things that, you know, he says, you're seeing him become one. And as he becomes one, he's bringing his followers along. So as we get to talk about how we feel about the Second Amendment, how we feel about the Constitution, how we feel about not only the right but the responsibility to defend and protect yourself, your person, your family, and your property, his followers, those who haven't heard that message, are getting that message now. And that's one of the dangerous things, and that's what scares Hillary Clinton out of her pantsuit, that they can no longer control the message. They can't just say he's a sexist and that he's a racist and have everybody believe it and not listen to what he says. He now has the ability to outpower them culturally, media-wise, and he's doing it. And he's giving conservatives a chance to insert our message to people who would have never listened to us before. And we would be damn fools if we let that opportunity pass without taking advantage to show people what we actually mean when we stand for things like the Second Amendment.
And one thing about Trump is he is pro-business because he's a business guy. He's pro-private sector, though, and he also understands how that can intersect with government, which some people have faulted him for, but that's, you know, that's reality, and he understands that. But he's pro-American, and I think the biggest problem that in the so-called crisis of conservatism and the Bill Kristols out there who have this fetish for trying to, you know, and fantasy of stopping Donald Trump have completely twisted the meaning of conservatism. Conservatism is not about globalism. It is not about Wall Streetism and maintaining a financier-friendly Fed. Conservatism is, more than anything else, pro-Americanism, keeping this country strong, enabling it to do so well and be such a shining example that other countries want to follow it, as opposed to fecklessly attempting to impose our ideas and our will across the world, which never has worked and never will. So when Trump, and we know Trump is pro-Second Amendment, he's made no bones about that, certainly in recent years. So the good thing is some of his specific issues and points where he is adhering more to the conservative line, they still connect, they are still consistent with his overall mantra for decades, which has been pro-American, for a strong, robust foreign policy, real politic, realism dealing with our allies and our enemies and our hostile nations. That all works together. It's not as if this man is, you know, picking from a Chinese restaurant menu positions. This stuff ties together, and he's actually more consistent. Donald Trump's positions are far more consistent than our Hillary Clinton's. This is a woman who was opposed to same-sex marriage. She has changed positions on virtually every major area of public policy. She was for single-payer health care, which was the catastrophe she presided over as first lady, and then tried to claim that Barack Obama's health plan when they were campaigning was too radical, and now says Bernie Sanders is too leftist, even though he's endorsing the very plan that she and her husband attempted to roll out in the early 90s.
And also, I like that he turned the war on women back on Hillary. I mean, if we're going to talk about
brilliant.
Who's treating women how, he said that you are looking to disarm vulnerable women. And I know that myself, I've never been a big gun person. I mean, I live in like a gated and secured place, but I'm also across the street from D.C., and there are parts of the city that it should be legally required to be there with a gun. I mean, I get the D.C. Police Department's Twitter feed to my phone, and I just look at some neighborhoods that are going off all day long with something going on. And I said, yeah, I would definitely have to have a gun being there. And, you know, to look and see the mayor say that she's not for it, and see other friends of mine and all the trouble that they've had to go through in getting a gun license, if they ever get one at all, it's kind of
and you know, there's not enough, Yvonne, there's not enough law enforcement to deal with the terrorist threat that we're seeing, the things like San Bernardino. There is not enough law enforcement. Law enforcement is called usually after the crime has gone down, not before. It is not preventative. It's not real time in almost every situation. Unless you have Secret Service protection like Hillary Clinton, in which case, yeah, then they are able to react real time. The average person, and certainly in a tough or low-income neighborhood, is not walking around with armed guards to protect them if something happens. And so it is actually in law enforcement's interest to have people that are responsible gun owners and trained to deal with unforeseen situations and violent situations. It is a force multiplier for law enforcement and for our efforts to battle terrorism if we have a really aggressive, coordinated program, and if the NRA and if law enforcement agencies and if veterans groups could come together and say, let's make this a national plan. Let's take these guns that are out there and are not going away and make sure they're in the hands of responsible, trained people. And I guess there are some that would argue, well, gee, if they're trained to use guns effectively, the criminals will become better shots.
Yeah.
they'll be more lethal. Well, that's always a risk. But let's face it, for 99% of the people that this kind of program or this kind of idea would involve would be responsible people who want to make their neighborhood safer and want to protect themselves, their family, and their friends. And I think, and that's to me what we ought to be looking at. How do we take the reality, take the situation as it is, which is 200 plus million guns in this country, and how do we turn that into a positive? How do we harness that as opposed to trying to fight it, which hasn't worked and will not work?
Well, you said it yourself. You are your first line of protection. We need to have more people who are going to arm themselves. And enough for gun control for now. This next one, Sonny spoke on last year on the Iran deal. For those who haven't noticed, the Iran nuke deal that the president was so thrilled to ink this year has been in the news lately. White House aide Ben Rhodes came out and said the entire thing was a lie. Ah, the same Iran deal that we drew a red line for, the same Iran we drew a red line for, and they gassed their own people right afterwards. The same Iran that right after the deal was written, they had our troops on their knees like they were auditioning for a Clinton White House intern position. Well, not only has this been revealed as a lie, a major surrogate of the administration was found to have donated $100,000 to NPR to help promote the lie and paid a number of journalists at the same time. Are we really surprised that someone was paid to lie? Remember the, if you like your insurance, you can keep it, the 2014 lie of the year? Lee, do you think any of this is going to hurt the Democrats in November?
Well, you know, I think the Iran deal indirectly is going to hurt the Democrats. I don't, unless we have more horrendous terrorist acts, either in the United States or in Western countries, I still think the economy is going to be front and center as the issue, but I think the Iran deal helps demonstrate the ineffective and misguided foreign policy of the Obama administration. And this donation by Plowshares, which is a bunch of misguided hedge fund billionaires, and they're friends of George Soros. And if you notice, Soros has donated alongside this organization that gave to NPR to a lot of entities and organizations that promoted that horrendous Iran deal. So these folks are misguided. And by the way, on that issue, I believe in transparency. You know, if they're going to take money, they need to divulge that they're taking money from an organization that has a very strong position on one side or the other.
But they are being transparent. You see that Ben Rhodes came out and said that it was a lie, like he actually admitted it.
Right.
This is the second time that, or you know, two of possibly
they
many.
Do,
the only two I can think of where they actually admitted that something was a lie. I mean, the president was caught in the lie about the insurance, where he twisted the words. He said, well, I never really said that. And he added, you know, added a little adjective in there. And
right.
The other reason why I'm not surprised, I mean, I've never been a fan of an attorney being president anyway. A person who is paid to lie told a lie. Why is that a surprise?
Right. Abraham Lincoln was a good one, but we don't have many Lincolns.
We created a word for this, like in the healthcare debacle. During the healthcare debacle, we created a word for this. We called it laying out a Gruber. You remember when he was the one who came out and told the truth that the numbers behind Obamacare were not true, and they found every way that they could to twist them and make them acceptable for the CBO. So, I mean, this is part and parcel for what they do. They do it on global warming. They did it with Black Lives Matter. This is how they operate. But the funny part is they are doing it in the information age. When Obama got into office, and everybody would, especially conservatives, we would listen to Obama speak, and we would be like, how could he just stand there and lie? Like, we knew he was lying. And how could he stand there with a straight face and just lie to the American people? And I even said then, those videos were not meant for us. Those interviews, they weren't meant for us. When the history of this period is written in progressive language, that means they make the shit up. When it is written in progressive language, they will use Obama's speeches. They will use his comments and his press conferences, proof of how good a president he was. Nobody will remember these lies. You know, and that is the point, because they rewrite history, just like they can make you think FDR was good for black people, or they can make you think Lyndon Johnson was good for black people. They rewrite the shit. That's what all of this is about. Nobody's going to remember these comments from Rhodes or Gruber. They're going to go back and they're going to play video of Obama speaking. They're going to show his eloquence, and they're going to show his grace, and they're going to say this is what was going on during that period to paint him as a good president. Even though the Middle East is falling apart, even though our healthcare system is falling apart, even though our economy can barely grow upon itself, they will attempt to make him a successful president so they can erect all kind of statues in his honor. That's all this is about, his legacy.
Well, you know, I think Donald Trump is the antidote for that. And the very reason he is doing well is that the American voter, and this is left and right, you know, if there's one thing that white guys in Mississippi and African Americans in the inner city of New York or Chicago have in common, is they both believe the system is rigged against them. And Donald Trump speaks to that. People know they're being lied to, and often it's syrupy sweet and it's beautifully expressed, but they know they've been lied to. They've been lied to about free trade. They've been lied to about internationalism. They've been lied to about deals like the Iran nuclear deal. They know they've been lied to, even though they may not understand all of the details of all of the policies. They know that our country is being undermined, it's being subverted, and that they want a truth teller. And even if the guy sometimes says things the wrong way or is inappropriate, they'd rather deal with that than the lies. And the irony is, when Donald Trump says something outrageous or is insulting in a way that he shouldn't be, that's pretty easy to spot. You know, you don't need to go to a think tank to parse his words to figure out what's wrong with what he just said. So people can deal with that. But when Ben Rhodes or Gruber are working behind the scenes to carefully weave a conspiracy of disingenuity and lies to push a public policy, that's pretty hard to untangle sometimes. And when it's delivered by a mellifluous spokesperson or president like Barack Obama, it isn't that easy to spot the lies, except perhaps in hindsight. So people would rather deal with Donald Trump's occasional spouting off inappropriately, which they can easily discern, but knowing that when he's talking about the policies and the rest of the stuff, he's much more likely to be telling the truth than what they've been getting, which is a whole lot of misinformation, lies, canards, diversion.
Yeah, if you notice, the more that the left tries to push and promote all of these insane, all the crazy things that Donald Trump has said, the larger his base grows, because it's for people like myself. I can let certain statements go because we know the guy and we have him and feel that given his record that he's going to do what he says he's going to do. So you can keep repeating these comments and we'll watch the commercials of the women who are mouthing or lip syncing to his profane tweets, and we'll laugh and still vote for him in the process. But for all the people who are looking at this, the Iran deal, and they say, oh, what, Obama's trying to fix the Middle East. Like, what's the problem with it? What's the issue Republicans have? I will repeat what Sunny said in her Tea Party speech last year in D.C. She said, ask the left how they feel about Obama's record, that everything that he touches fails. Ask the House and the Senate that he lost in 2010 and again in 2012, which is likely going to happen again in 2016, the number of times that he's failed to keep his promises. So why is it that we expect this deal to be any different?
This was Obama. Obama can't travel to Iran. If Obama could, say, if Obama was politically safe in that aspect, he would travel to Iran. I mean, look where he is today. You know, he would have traveled to Iran, but he couldn't. This is his equivalent.
He could do Cuba, but not Iran. He had to draw the line.
They had to draw the line somewhere. But if he could, he would. And he would go and he would bow to Iran like he bowed to every other. This is his bow. This is him saying, I acknowledge I can't make the same promise to you that I made in Egypt when I first got into office, and look at Egypt now. So Iran better be glad that he didn't come, you know, in the beginning, because, you know, maybe they would be going through the same situation as Egypt. But this is his bow. This is his way of saying, America, I'm going to take them down a peg or two for how they've been acting in the Middle East. This is my reward. We're not going to do anything with Syria. We're going to let you expand your power base. I'm going to say that we want Assad out, but I'm not going to actually do anything to get Assad out. This is my nod to you. This is my bow to you to say that it's okay for you to go ahead and start building your military presence, your economic presence, your dominant force presence in the Middle East. They act like they don't understand that these people want a caliphate. They don't lie about it. They don't tell you that it's something else that they are trying to do. The clerics, the people that are in charge, they tell you that they want a caliphate. They want to rebuild a huge Muslim state in the Middle East. That's what they're doing. They're consolidating the power to do it. We're giving them the money to do it. And ISIS is creating the instability for them to do it. Everything
and negotiating with terrorists is such a great idea, right?
Everything is being laid at their feet for them to have their caliphate, for them to start what they think is going to be the bloody revolution of this world, where every knee will bow to Allah. And we are sitting here acting like this is some tryst in the Middle East that doesn't concern us. It is coming to us, and if we do not understand what we're fighting with, fighting for, fighting against, then Barack Obama wins, and America will lose.
Well, that's why Trump says it very simply. We're going to bomb the hell out of ISIS, and it can be done.
Correction.
The other thing we have to
do
is
am going to bomb the
out.
Shit out of ISIS. That's what he said. I just had to clarify that point.
Hey, well, yeah, thank you. He said both. I think it depends on the audience. But,
okay.
But the point is, I mean, the first thing we have to do is remove their cash cow. And if we did things like develop all of our energy resources in the United States, which Trump has certainly been pushing very hard. In fact, I think he's giving a speech on energy security this week. Then if you remove the cash cow and if you lessen or eliminate American dependence on Middle East oil and reduce the Western world's dependence on Middle East oil and the Asian nations, then, frankly, what happens over there is a whole hell of a lot less salient than it is now. It doesn't mean you don't have to watch it, and the big issue then becomes weapons of mass destruction and nuclear weapons getting in the hands of ISIS or Iran eventually, which it's on track to have happen. But that's more manageable than the risk of an international economic calamity that would result if the House of Saud was overthrown in Saudi Arabia, and either ISIS or an Iranian, Syrian, Russian caliphate got control of Iranian, or rather Saudi Arabian oil, that becomes a huge economic issue, which is why we have to focus on energy security in this country. And one thing, you talk about lies, there's a technology that Ohio State University developed, which was funded in part by the Department of Energy, but also private sector companies, that is a clean coal technology that works. It's not carbon capture, and I don't mean to be too esoteric here, but the upshot is it's a way of getting the energy out of coal without burning it. It's chemical loop technology. This technology, if it were scaled, could make the trillion barrels of oil equivalent that we have in coal in this country usable with dramatically less emissions than is currently the case. And you have not heard a word about this from the government because they don't want to go there.
Yeah, you're making an assumption that this is actually about the environment or like that's
no,
not.
No, destroy the coal industry. Coal is bad.
Exactly.
Coal is bad.
And not only that, it is the way forever and ever. If we're not energy efficient as a country, then that's the knife they hold over our throat, over our necks, when they can fluctuate the prices of oil so quickly and so fast. That's what they hold over our neck that makes us have to go over there and mess around in the Middle East. But more importantly, it's what American politicians use to scare us to death and make us dependent upon them, not only for our safety, but for our electricity. They want us dependent on them, and that's why they refuse to make us energy independent, because then they can no longer scare us into actions in the Middle East or actions across the globe that really have nothing to do with us. So
absolutely.
That is another
foreign entanglements, as our founding father said.
Yep. And that's what they use it for.
And they also don't believe in a free market economy and consumerism. So if we have an energy problem in this country, that's very beneficial to folks on the left who don't even like free enterprise, don't even like consumer choice, don't even like people going out and having the ability to buy nice things after they work hard. They don't believe in that system, and the way to choke it off is to limit the availability of energy.
Yeah,
this whole environmental is subterfuge. It's subterfuge. I mean, Van Jones said when he was still in the Obama administration, and Jones is exceptionally effective as a speaker and an analyst, even though I obviously vehemently disagree with him on most things. But one thing he said at a speech was, even if we had, and it gets to the point Sonny was making about this pseudo-environmentalism, even if we had clean energy sources, Well, that would be bad because that would just mean we'd be using clean energy to power this bad economy, this evil economy, I'm paraphrasing. So the point is the real issue or the real goal is not a clean environment. It is state control of what people do and their choices. It's control of how people live. It's undermining the ability of our economy to do what it does best when it's unfettered. That's what they don't like. And this environmentalism, climate change, all of that is a fantastic patina to use for state control and for attenuation of the dynamism of this economy. Not that it needs much attenuation, as Sonny also pointed out. We've never had in the history of this country, or certainly modern history, we have never had a decade of below 3% annual growth, but we have just crossed that ignominious threshold. We've now had the longest duration of subpar economic performance in our history, and that includes the Great Depression of the 30s, the panic in the late 19th century. We have never had a period of a decade of this kind of anemic economic growth, and the jobs that has cost, the incomes that has eroded, is a crime, and there's no excuse for it.
And Lee, you mentioned a few energy points of some different types of energies that I have not energy sources I haven't heard of. So yeah, you gave me a research project after that.
Yeah, the Ohio Dr. Fan, F-A-N. He's of Asian descent. Dr. Fan and his team at Ohio State University, or the Ohio State University, as they prefer to call it, has developed this technology, and it's not being scaled. I mean, the government is hiding it, and they're slow walking it.
And I just have to mention, when you mentioned government,
it should be a Manhattan project. It should be. And if we believe in low emissions, keep in mind when we talk about killing the U.S. coal industry, well, we're killing the electric power dimension of the coal industry. But coal is being mined. Guess where it's going increasingly? It's being shipped overseas. We're shipping coal to China and other nations which have egregiously lax emissions laws. And it's being burned over there, burned in plants that would never pass muster in the United States. So if we believe we're one planet and we truly believe that carbon is bad and that it's a global threat, why in the world would we create a paradigm where we're shipping this supposedly noxious fuel, coal, to countries that have grossly lax standards that we would never accept in the United States? That shows the perfidy and how disingenuous these people really are. Instead of, again, as I mentioned with guns, we've got this coal. It's here. China has a bunch of coal. They don't have very much oil, certainly compared to us, but they have a tremendous amount of coal. They're going to burn that coal. China is building coal-fired power plants at breakneck speed, and they're committing
it's
in 30 years.
Hypocrisy.
They might do some,
hypocrisy at its finest. I'm sorry to cut you off. I've got to move on for time.
So. Yeah, yeah. We need to spread the clean coal around the world. Instead of fighting coal, we need to clean it up, and we have the ability to do it.
Yes, if that is their actual goal. And
that were the goal.
Not of the left, yes. I feel like I'm looking at these topics, and I feel like I'm just kind of picking on Sonny today, but got to throw in one more. Jab, this next one is very personal to Ms. Johnson because I know she shares this young lady's struggle. Sports Illustrated model Emily Ratajkowski, I'm not saying that again, says she has trouble landing serious acting.
We'll just call her Emily.
Yes. Emily says she has trouble landing serious acting roles because she's so sexy. And this is what she had to say. If you're a sexy actress, it's hard to get serious roles. You get offered the same thing that they've seen you in all the time. And what's so dumb is that women are 50% of the population, and they want to spend money to see movies where they're portrayed as three-dimensional characters. I'd also like to add that earlier this year, she took a selfie with her top off with Kim Kardashian. So, I mean, I really don't think she's trying very hard to shed that sexy image. I'm not aware of Sunny taking photos like that. And And I can hear Lee over there Googling.
Oh, no.
But would you like to tell us about your struggles working while maintaining all of what you call – what did you call it? The hashtag
goodness. Yes, it is. No, when I first started, okay, I've been called attractive since I was 14, 15 years old. So I've gotten to the point where now I just say thank you and I keep it moving. Half the time when guys are checking me out, I don't even pay attention to it. So my husband will be like, did you see that guy looking at you? And I'm like, what guy? Because I'm like, I want to see who it was, see where I'm ranking these days. But, you know, I don't even notice it anymore because that's kind of the place that I've come to. When I got into the conservative movement, I, like, went out and bought pantsuits and, like, jackets and freaking skirts that came down to my knees. And I fucking hated it. I hated it. I was like, this is nothing about me. This is all me conforming to you, and I'm not going to do it. And it was soon after that I was like, hey, my assets are my long legs. That means I like short skirts. And I don't care what conservatives have to say about it. I am years old with one child and I still have
You're grown.
And I still have a flat belly and, you know, I'm in fit shape looking good. And my husband told me one time, why would you stop when you still got it? Why would you start hiding it before, you know what I'm saying, it actually goes away? One day you're not going to look like that. So as long as you look like that, rock it. And that's what I do. But that also leads to I don't post. I'm not on Instagram. I'm not taking pictures of me everywhere I go. I don't change my pictures on Facebook and Twitter because that's what is not what it's about for this instance. For this instance, you need to be listening to what I have to say, not commenting on what I look like. That's why I keep shit stagnant in those areas. But in my normal life, if you run up to me, I had a black brother from the GOP who had saw me on Twitter, and he saw me in person. He was like, dear God, girl. He spends like 30 minutes talking about how attractive I am and how good I look. Afterwards, when we go home, he texted me and like, I like to work with you. And I haven't responded to him. You had the opportunity of me being in your face and talking about these issues, but you rather spend the time talking about how I look. So now I don't have time to talk to you about issues. You wasted your opportunity. So it kind of cuts both ways.
And betrayed his real motive, too, while he was at it.
Exactly.
But don't worry, I was showing the ring.
I made sure I showed the ring, and I put it out to let him know. But that didn't stop him. But it also eliminated
sometimes that encourages people. Sometimes, you know, they say a wedding ring is the sexiest accoutrement either a man or a woman can wear.
And ladies and gentlemen, that is how you deal with an attractive woman.
Yep.
No, you say she's attractive. You say you're beautiful, and she'll say thank you. Then walk the hell away unless she doesn't have on a ring, and you actually want to make a play at her. But in this thing, when I would go on Red Eye, they would sit me in the leg chair. The leg chair is specifically, that's what it's called. It's specifically designed for the beautiful one on the panel. So when they sat me in the leg chair, I made sure my dress was small. I made sure it fit. I made sure it was short because that's what the chair was freaking for. It was for a sexy woman to sit in it, and not only show that she was sexy, but to also go back and forth with the likes of Ambassador Bolton and Greg Gutfeld and some of the other names that came on the show and show their intelligence, show their humor. So you can see that entire package. And until conservatives start realizing that you can have the entire package, even if it looks a little different from the normal packaging, you know, it is still the complete package. And if I have to introduce that concept to them, I would do it ever so humbly.
That's your gift to the conservative movement, Sonny. and it's profound. And, you know, Emily, apparently, you know, Julia Roberts and Halle Berry have done okay, and they've done some pretty damn serious roles as actresses.
But one sec, the Halle Berry joke, it's funny that you even bring that up, because Halle Berry wanted to play the mother in Losing Isaiah. And when she went in and rehearsed for the role, they told her no because she was too beautiful. So she went home. And for 2 weeks, she did not comb her hair. She did not brush her teeth. She did not take a bath. She did not change her clothes. And then she went in and re-auditioned for the part, smelling like it, looking like it, decayed like it, because she played a crackhead in that movie. And she broke herself down to go back and to audition for that part. And she got that part in that movie. And that's one of the best movies that Halle Berry has ever acted in my opinion. So
right.
It goes to tell you that maybe the way that you get these more serious roles is by making yourself applicable for them and not taking topless shots with Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God, you went back in the history tank with that one. I mean, that movie was old. I still...
Well, but
mine
and Monsters Ball. I mean, Monsters Ball too. I mean, she's done some wonderful performances, as has Julia Roberts, and I don't think anybody would claim they're not incredibly beautiful women. Meryl Streep is kind of on the other track, certainly a very attractive woman, but a different kind of look, and you wouldn't say, you know, you wouldn't pick her out as an ingenue or someone that got where she is solely based on appearance. But I think Sonny makes a great point. If you really go after the role, and if you inhabit the role, and if you do the kind of prep that's required to meet the criteria for the role, there's no reason a very attractive actress or actor can't get those kinds of roles. So that's a pretty lame excuse, if you ask me, that Emily put forward there. So I'm surprised she would even give voice to that.
Yeah, it was kind of, felt like it was kind of a silly statement. And while we are molding ourselves for certain roles, I'm glad that Sonny has decided not to be a 30-year-old Nancy Reagan. And I just
thank you. I appreciate
awesome.
That. You have
and
no
I,
struggle, man.
And I want you to continue molding what conservative women are supposed to look like or can look like, because we know that not everyone can do what you do. So. You are appreciated, Sonny.
Aww.
It's important. An important face of the right of center movement in this country.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, and now for one of my favorite conservative talk radio people, Rush Limbaugh. He said what many of us are thinking about this election. The Republican convention this summer is going to be the pay-per-view program to watch. I mean, who wants to watch the geriatric show with Bernie and Hillary? And her Kangles. We know this to be true, and the networks know the same. That's why Rush said that if Democrats want to compete with the RNC for ratings this summer, he suggests they pull out Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky, a bid, and let's recreate that infamous blue dress scene. Sonny, how do you envision the Democratic convention to be?
Oh, I think politically wise, it is going to be more explosive than anything on the RNC. So as it goes towards the specific politics of it, you're having the socialists fight for the Democratic Party. And, like, we've been calling them, like, if we called them socialists 8 years ago, 6 years ago, they were telling us we were crazy. Do you
yeah.
remember that?
And it was rude.
The conservative would remember that. Like, we would be like, they're
it's
socialists.
A huge insult.
Yes, but now they've taken off the mask and they're like openly socialist, and we're like openly going to fight the Democratic Party to put socialism in as the mantra. It is going to be politically charged at the Democratic convention. But I'm looking forward to being – I will be at the Republican convention. So I am looking forward to Donald Trump reshaping everything about the way Republicans think these events should be laid out. I get so bored. I get so frustrated. I hate the music. I'm sorry, but there is only so much I can hear about Ronald Reagan. It's like – every one of these conferences is the exact same thing. Everyone.
I'm ready for another example. I have nothing against him. I think that he was a wonderful man. But can we please talk about someone else. I mean, Rubio was saying that if he could meet anyone, I think, who was dead during one of the debates, that he would meet Reagan. And I was like, what were you in, like, the sixth grade or something when he was in office? I think it was something like that. And people said, well, does that mean that you can't study Lincoln? No, but I'm just saying.
I would have picked Lincoln, but I saw Reagan speak in person a couple of times, so maybe I don't feel quite the need to meet him. But you know, one quick thing I just want to interject. Sonny, and both of you alluded to this. One of Trump's keys, you know, I mentioned earlier that he's managed to, people understand that he's not lying to them. He conveys authenticity, and they're tired of being lied to by both parties and by supposedly what are supposedly two different ideologies in this country. But the other thing that Trump has going for him, he is not boring. And if you watch that man do a rally, you can sit there transfixed for an hour. He's hysterical. He's a natural. He's not boring.
How can you turn down a person who's able to rally a base like that? I mean, you can, instead of railing against this person, it would be to your benefit to try and work with him and shape him as a candidate.
They can't control him. They don't like him because they can't control him. That's the bottom line.
I'm looking forward to the highlight of the Republican convention not being Clint Eastwood on stage with an empty chair. Like, I am actually looking forward.
Truly horrendous. That was the low point.
I am looking forward to something that resembles what normal American people, like, conservatives want the principles, right? I'm like, do you understand that in addition to the principles, we have an American culture? And so the principles talk to people's head while the culture speaks to people's heart. Why can't you have both? Where you're
the culture is evil.
Their head and their heart. And that is why every single Republican lost. Every single Republican lost to Donald Trump because they refused to understand that the culture is also important. It doesn't mean it's the be-all, end-all.
It's important, but you know.
It has to be an ingredient in the soup if the soup is going to taste good.
Or if it is culture, it can't be our culture because, as you said, hip-hop allegedly has no redeeming value. And when you said that you hated the music, I was supposed to have a Lil Wayne instrumental playing for the intro, and I kind of hit the wrong button or set the wrong button to start.
You know what, though? The tradition in American politics, which, again, as people have known, unfortunately too few people have knowledge of history, showmanship and fusing culture and politics and issues is actually American tradition. Abraham Lincoln was an entertainer. I mean, you got to remember, when Abraham Lincoln was trekking around Illinois speaking, when he was running for Senate, people didn't have comedians. They didn't have comedy clubs, never mind electronic communication. There was nobody funny to listen to. They would watch that man for 2 and 3 hours because he was hysterical. He was brilliant. He was learned. He was clear and piercing.
And Ronald Reagan had fights. He was an actor.
And Reagan was an actor and an entertainer. So the idea that part and parcel of politics isn't entertainment and making people enjoy getting the message is crazy. And this
you're not supposed to be enjoying watching him. This has to be serious. How dare you laugh during a speech? Oh my God, that's
you know what? As discursive and as funny as Donald Trump is, I have never seen a politician that has better message discipline than Donald Trump. He always alludes to the vets, to the wall, to our trade issues. He never fails to get that in, but he does it and he insinuates it into the rally or into the speech or into the talk in a way that's entertaining and different, and he moves it around. You know, Ronald Reagan was famous for reshuffling his index cards. You know, he had index cards with jokes and with lines, and he would put them in a different order to make, you know, add some variety and maybe to keep from completely boring his traveling press corps. And in effect, Donald Trump does that in his brain. He rearranges the index cards in his brain, and he sprinkles in some topical allusions. And the man is just a natural. And that ability to entertain, to communicate, to not make it boring, is so crucial to his effectiveness. And I think it's also the reason that he has irritated and angered so many in the so-called establishment because they can't do that, and the politicians that they have anointed can't do that, and it's extremely frustrating.
I mean, we saw what happened when Rubio tried it.
Well, you know, yeah. Rubio is actually can be very funny, and if you know,
I mean,
funny.
He can
if
be
Rubio
that,
had
is, I mean,
that way. If Rubio had started that way, he might have been able to pull it off.
I don't even think that would have. I mean, the lines that he was using against Trump were scripted. I mean, Trump is a natural. I mean, this was his
right.
personality that he was giving during these debates. I mean, the
right.
Air Force One and whatnot was funny, but those were scripted jokes. That just was not him.
It's not just Trump's. It's a secondary part to the cultural appeal. And his love of capitalism, his love of his own wealth, is the second part of that cultural appeal. Because
authenticity.
He doesn't act like, okay, he won't say, I'm a hip-hop fan. I don't even know what kind of music he listens to. But he will put hip-hop artists into his hotels. You know, he will make sure that if his brand can eat off of hip-hop, you can make sure that he'll make sure his brand eats off of it. And that basic acknowledgement is what is getting most of Black America to look at him because they see the attitude, they see the swagger, they see the non-apologetic way he says, I worked for what I have. And that is the overarching message that is coming out of hip-hop culture. And that is what is going to attract a lot of Blacks towards Donald Trump. And I don't care what polls you are looking at today, a lot of the Blacks that are going to vote for Donald Trump, they're not going to say they are. They're not going to admit
right.
they are. They're not going to talk to you
a
about it.
A lot of Republicans didn't admit it until he was the presumptive nominee. A lot of Republicans weren't admitting it in polls. Hey, Sonny, I've got a question for you. If you had to say one thing that Donald Trump should do to actually make any kind of significant inroads into the African American vote, what should he do? Is there something that comes to mind?
He should hire Sonny Johnson. Realize that some things you can't do, and you find, like he says, the best people that are able to do it. I know the conservative message. I have been around the conservative crowd, even the Never Trump people who cannot deny my authenticity as a right-wing, nut job, Bible-thumping, gun-toting, you know, conservative. And at the same time, I have an enormous amount of love for my community, and I am willing to humble myself I will be able to humble myself to them to get that message into a community that desperately needs it. That can't be taught to someone. You have to do what Donald Trump says. Pick the people that are best for it and send them in. And I have an army a few of us is enough to build the army. So that would be my suggestion. Don't try to do
what the American Revolution started with a very small army.
And that's it.
Can I, I want to isolate that whole little question, Q&A segment that you two did, and that needs to be sent to Donald Trump.
Go ahead.
All right, I love it.
Absolutely, that was awesome. And look, I have a little faith in on the left when it comes to the Democratic Convention. I mean, look at Hillary. You know, remember the overseas train station terrorist attack that happened? I said that the Pentagon could save a little money. Save a little military funding. Just put Hillary outside. I told Sonny this. She could be on all fours and practice her bedroom kink with Bill Clinton and bark like a dog. She could reprise her role in Roots or Driving Miss Daisy with that slave master accent she likes to use every time she goes to South Carolina.
She could pull the hot sauce out of her bag and show how much she likes to put on a piece of chicken.
Or she could have Larry Wilmore introduce her to his nigga like he did Obama.
You're
okay.
Right. All of those things could happen. Or they could boo God again. That would be fun.
Oh, God. Oh, gosh. Okay.
That would be fun.
Now, enough of that. Now, finally, actress Blake Lively went on Instagram after the Cannes Film Festival in France posting friend back pics of her dress saying she has an L.A. face with an Oakland booty. For those who don't know, that's a lyric from rapper Sir Mix-a-Lot, who, by the way, he's way beyond my, it's before my time. But anyway, everyone came out calling her racist for it and whatever. Personally, I didn't see anything wrong with it because it looks like it was true. I mean, judging by the pictures. But, I mean, if you've got it, you've got it. Sonny, as a woman who also has an L.A. face and Oakland booty, are you offended by a white woman saying that she also has the same thing?
Look,
please don't send
even,
your husband after me.
No, I'm not going to even, I won't even justify this with an answer. Because if this is the worst of America's racism, then clap your fucking hands and be blessed that you live here. If this is the best that you have, then I don't want to hear about white privilege. I don't want to hear if this is your main claim to a racist America. You are doing it all wrong. We had our ancestors were beat down, stripped, separated from their families, sold off as property. You want to talk about, you know what? This is the conversations that make me realize some black people can't be saved. Because if you jump to this as a call for racism and then use that to validate why your ass is broke, then you don't need to be saved. You will never be saved, and I hope you live under the racist rat hole that you built for yourself. I'm sorry,
that's a tough
I didn't
act
know
to
how
follow.
I felt about it.
That was good.
That's a tough act to follow. I will say, by the way, there are two things I'm trying to never say. One is I could be wrong, you know, when I make a prediction, because what prediction might not be wrong. That's ridiculous. So I don't say I could be wrong. I just make the prediction. And I try not to say, as a white person, X, you know, I'll just say what I think. And if somebody who's African American wants to, or white for that matter, wants to call me out or say it's inappropriate or insensitive or whatever, let them do it. But I don't feel the need to put a disclaimer on the opinions. But that being said, I think the problem is, if there is any problem here, and I would not, as Sonny said, rank this as among the top issues in our country, I think the problem is whenever someone outside of a people group characterizes another people group, especially if it's African Americans or a group that's historically been subjugated in the country, then that's a problem. And now, the other problem is two other people had apparently don't use the same lyrics on their Instagram, apparently Katy Perry and Khloe Kardashian did the same thing. So, you know what, if you're a well-known actress and a celebrity and you're going to do an Instagram and you're going to put a clever caption, don't be derivative. Come up with something original, right? So she used something that two other people had used, number one. Number two, don't if you're a white person, steer clear of anything that smacks of an African-American stereotype. I mean, look, what I would say, my question would be, what's wrong with the Oakland faces? You know, you know, that's and I think that's part of the problem with what she said, even though it was quoting a lyric. The lyric was from an African-American rapper, right? It was not from a white person. It does make a difference.
And it
implies that a white face is prettier, you know, that you want an African-American derriere and you want a white face that's blonde.
Well, the lyric is L.A. face.
Sir Mix-a-Lot slept with a whole bunch of white girls. Okay? The reason that they use the song is because white people have brought it out. It's not that black people don't like the song, but it's constantly used in marketing and advertising by white people. You know, like the reason that it's the number one hit for him, the reason it stays out in the public eye, the reason that even teenagers know about it today is not because blacks keep bringing it up in relevance. It's because whites use it and advertise it in movies for whatever purpose it is that they're using it at the time. But that doesn't take away from the fact that I'm skinny. I don't have the big booty, but there's a whole bunch of white girls whose rumps are a lot bigger than mine. I'm not talking about the white girls that go get injections. Boo, you don't count. But the white girls that have it naturally, I mean, what? So they have the big, you know, the big butt. And there's a lot of white men that like the more cushion for the pushing, just like the brothers like it when they see a big booty on a sister. So stop trying to make these things, which are human nature, basic human nature of a man looking at a woman and liking the derriere, liking to lay on it, liking to grab it and pinch it. Stop making basic human nature about race, because that's not what it is. And we should be happy that white girls are now coming out being happy, full, you know, with at least a little bit of a fuller figure, instead of keep pushing that Barbie doll stereotype that I had to grow up with my entire childhood, that says if you're not a perfect size 2 in the waist, that you're not a beautiful woman. It's about time you have white actresses coming out and saying that is not a standard for not only black girls to live up to, but for little white girls to live up to either.
That's a great point.
And you know why I brought this topic?
By the way, she's a serious actress. Here's the other irony. We were talking about actresses earlier.
She's an attractive woman.
She's a very attractive woman and a hell of an actress, and nobody has ever said she's not a serious actress.
Because she doesn't take topless photos with Kim Kardashian.
I think the problem, again, is that when you're always in risky territory if you're a white person making humorous remarks or alluding to characteristics.
But these people are going to always be offended. I mean, that's just the thing. They're going to be offended, period.
I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that if you're a white person, especially if you're a celebrity, you need to check yourself because there's usually no reason to go there. There are better ways to express things, right? Why, unless your goal is to piss some people off or raise questions.
I thought it was cute. And Sir Mix-a-Lot himself was perfectly fine with the statement. He responded in her defense.
He thought they made a big deal out of nothing.
I agree with Lee and the prospect that, like, if you know some shit is going to be offensive in front of the audience that you're going, you know, then you don't say it because it's going to offend your audience, unless, of course, you came to offend your audience.
From a PR
standpoint, unfortunately, you're right. It does work that way. I know that for me.
By the way, forgive me for interrupting. I just want to say it also distracts. Let's say, you know, if you're going out and you're saying something, you're trying to make a point. Whatever you say that is racially charged or could be perceived as racially charged by a significant number of people, that's going to get the attention and the focus. And if that's your goal, fine. But if you say or do anything else that you want paid attention to in that session, believe me, nobody's going to hear about it. All they're going to hear about is the racially charged comment.
And that's going to be your headline on all the blog sites.
Absolutely.
And I know that from experience that is
don't
the
know
truth.
That. Just know that and own that.
That needs to stay in the political realm. As far as you want people to have advocacy to follow you or to listen to you, or the nonprofit realm, the political realm, you know, those kind of realms where you want that, on social media, that should not be the standard. It should not be a thing that white people should be afraid to say. I'm a black person, and there is no shit that I'm afraid to say because I'm scared I'll offend a white person. As a heterosexual, there is no shit that I'm afraid to say because I think I'm going to offend a gay person. I am just going to be respectful to the people who are respectful to me and love on the people that love on me. If you come to me with the BS, don't be surprised I give it back to you. But white people, you're the ones who cower, the ones who you know, manage their words so carefully, you're the reason why white people can't go and talk to black people. Because we know you're full of shit. We know that you have minced your words to make sure that we think that you are acceptable. And my favorite type of white person is a person that doesn't care that I'm black. And you can instantly find this out when you talk to them. And like you said, Lee, they don't add the qualifiers. Like, I know I'm a white lady. When you take that out and you just make your statement, I understand that you don't have a racist bone in your body. You're just inquisitive. But when
and by
you
the way, I think if,
put the qualifiers
if more white
in,
people,
that's where,
yeah.
Yeah, and if more white people stood up and said the shit that needs to be said, you would find a lot less of this, like this empowerment of blacks to actually think, I have the right to say any damn thing I want because I am somehow in an oppressed society and no one can monitor my speech, but I can tell a white person what they can't say. No, it doesn't work like that. Freedom of speech works the same for everybody. And I am one that will pass that message on to black people, and more white people need to be passing that message on too, and stop censoring their damn selves for kitty feelings.
You know what, Sonny? I think that thing about freedom of speech, if more white people, especially in the political realm, exercise their right of free speech to talk in a meaningful, serious way about issues that disproportionately affect African Americans, like the inner cities, like the horrendous government-controlled K-12 schools that our poorest children are tethered to around the country, if they were talking about those things in a really serious way, and I don't mean just attacking government, but really laying out what we can do about this and why there's a conspiracy of silence on the greatest racist endeavor in America, which is the government-controlled K-12 schools in large cities, if they talk seriously about that stuff, then an occasional joke that might rub a few African Americans the wrong way wouldn't be such a big deal. The problem is it's a vacuum. And white leaders, especially on the right, aren't talking about this stuff. They don't think they need, by and large, to address African Americans or the issues that asymmetrically affect them. So when they do make it blurt out something or something is ascribed to them that seems racially insensitive, that characterizes them. And by the way, if you're talking seriously about issues that are of profound interest to African Americans, that means you're going to be talking to and with more African Americans, you're probably a lot less likely to blurt out something stupid or insensitive because you're going to know your people and you're going to know who you're talking to.
Exactly.
And you're going to understand their feelings.
And standing
and
in their face,
in
which is something that you don't
happening.
Do very often.
Yeah, well, and white, the Republican Party, I mean, look at Paul Ryan, who I'm really hacked off at with his, he's treating the Trump endorsement as a multi-stage job interview, you know, as, instead of, hey, he's the leader of the party, I need to endorse him, and, you know, we can talk about policy later. But putting that aside, Ryan is a good, decent, highly intelligent guy. But what did he, you know, blurt out in trying to make his point about changing our poverty, anti-poverty programs? He made this statement, which he later recanted and apologized for, about generations of people in the inner cities not knowing what work is, et cetera. You know, he didn't say that out of malevolence. He said that because he doesn't get it. He's not interacting on a regular basis with the folks that are affected in the inner cities and that are dealing with
these. I have to disagree with that. Paul Ryan is one of the best that the GOP has to go into these communities and lay out an economic strategy. The problem with Paul Ryan is Paul Ryan doesn't have a damn spine. He went to Mitt Romney in 2012 and said, let's go into these inner cities. Let's go into these places that Republicans do not go. It was Mitt Romney who told Ryan no, because if we did that, we would upset the rest of the base that are supporting us. So we're just going to keep our attention on the base instead of going into these communities.
I'm sure Stuart Stevens. Helped with that too, the mastermind of the Romney collapse.
And that is my problem. They have the message. They know the message. And the Republican Party, the people at the top, refuse to go in and fight Democrats where it fucking counts. And if they don't understand that this is the reason that their party is in full rebellion, then they will never understand it. And I believe that.
So, Sonny, we're actually in agreement. Sonny, we're actually in agreement on that. We're a lot more in agreement than disagree. Maybe the Paul Ryan and what he wanted to do. And I know that's true. He's wanted to carry that message. My point is, he doesn't quite get it. You know, he may know the lyrics, but he doesn't know the music. And that is just. He's a hell of a lot further along than most Republicans. Most Republicans aren't even talking about these issues.
At all.
Aren't even attempting to connect with African Americans.
No, but they'd rather flip their middle finger at Donald Trump and vote for Hillary Clinton so that she can bring in Bill Clinton back in the White House so that he can spend another 4 years out in the community doing what, Sonny? Out raping and pillaging women across America.
Yeah, no, that's our, listen. That's what Rush Limbaugh got right. They're not gonna have to bring the bed and Lewinsky out of the convention because if Hillary's in the White House, that's what you're gonna have with other women. You know, the idea of making that guy first man is pretty horrifying. By the way, you know, Clinton's the guy that invented mass incarceration and imploded African American wealth. You know, the only African American that benefited from the Clintons was Franklin Raines, the former White House official that Clinton allowed to take over Fannie Mae and who doled out millions and millions of bonuses to himself and his people while they were creating the paradigm that would crush the housing market and disproportionately collapse African-American wealth in this country, which they're still climbing out from and still underwater on.
Well, you know, Ron Brown has a lot of wealth, you know, that is up until
Ron Brown,
until plane fell out of the sky, right. I'm just saying.
But the point is that the truth needs to be told that when Hillary Clinton says she's going to put Bill Clinton in charge of revitalizing the economy, that is like putting a drug dealer in charge of drug rehabilitation. The policies that he fomented, whether it's NAFTA, whether it's laying the foundation for China entering the World Trade Organization and unfettered trade with China, unleashing Wall Street and creating a new donor base for the Democratic Party, which that was basically designed to do, the housing, the crazy housing program and housing construct that they put together with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and forcing these subprime loans into the system, and then their buddies on Wall Street securitized them and made a fortune and put the trade deficit dollars that Japan and China had into those securities. That horrible rubric that was created by the Clintons. Now, George W. Bush didn't do anything to roll it back or stop it, so he deserves an enormous amount of blame as well. And a lot of Republicans were along for the ride on this. But that fundamental paradigm was put in place by Bill Clinton. Unfettered trade, unleashed Wall Street, and a Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac on steroids, and then on top of that, a financier-friendly Federal Reserve. That is a recipe for economic catastrophe, which is exactly what we got.
And the sad part is that out of all of that,
good old days from the first black president.
Yes, and out of all the accessing that Hillary was doing to Obama, you see that he's even come out and said, when you hear people talk about the good old days, you might want to remember they weren't quite so good.
No, they weren't. They weren't.
That didn't even win her his support.
And by the way, the day Bill Clinton stepped out of office, we entered a recession. You know, Dick Cheney, to his credit, not a guy I agree with a lot of times, but Dick Cheney on Meet the Press, before George W. Bush was inaugurated, said, I think we're headed for a recession. Keep in mind, this was nearly a year before 9/11. He said, I think we're headed for a recession. Now, you could say he was lowering expectations, but he was exactly right. That recession started almost the moment, and the internet bubble began to pop the moment Bill Clinton walked out of office. He got out just in time, but he and his administration fomented this, and then it took another, you know, 6 or 7 years for the housing disaster that they created to come home to roost.
And not to mention that he was in office. He just so happened to be there in time for the .com bubble to start.
Right, and
so
after the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed, they cut defense spending to even lower
absolutely
than what Obama has proposed,
global
3% of GDP.
Up.
So we cut what today would be the equivalent of $200 billion a year in defense spending. We had an ocean of capital gains tax revenue that came in from the dot-com boom. So you put those two together, and, yeah, we were able to balance the budget, at least on paper, for a couple of years. And had the Republican Party not taken over Congress in 94, we wouldn't have even had that. So, you know, even with that extra revenue and even with the defense cuts, they still would have found a way to maintain deficits if the Republicans hadn't taken over. But this entire, I call it the malevolent
debt. The whole reason America forgot, and this goes back to what I said earlier about Obama. The whole reason that America forgot exactly what it was like at the end of Clinton's presidency, where everything was starting to actually get shaky, they forget because it's rewritten. They have taken it and they have put the progressive spin on it, and that has allowed Bill Clinton's numbers to skyrocket from where they were when he got out of office to now he's one of the most beloved figures in America, because progressives constantly get to rewrite this history, and it's going to be
the media helps them do it.
No exception this time, if people like us don't make sure that we let them know that the effects of this, and we can't be Republicans that allow a Donald Trump, even though I'm supporting him, we can't allow him to come in and to become another Bush, to come in and put wars off the books like they don't count, to come in and to not take seriously the things that we sent them into office to take care of. And that's another problem where we have defeat in the left, is because we can't say, look what the Republicans did, because the Republicans got in, and by the time they were leaving, you had George Bush saying, I have to abandon capitalism in order to save it. So what
after making the biggest foreign policy blunder since the Vietnam War. But, you know, Sonny, you make a great – I think it was Lenin that said those who write history control history, and that's why the communists always made such a point of rigorously controlling what was in the history books, what was allowed to be written about the past, you know, expunging people from history. They understood that. And what we have now is a pliant media, and we have a lot of left-wing authors and publishing houses and editors –
And that's why the left is against school choice, because they need to have those public schools so that they can control the message for the next generation.
They cannot have charter schools that tell the truth. They cannot have
the
American
people
get educated. If they have the American people get educated, they lose everything. Because once the American public starts to feel empowered against their government, the government will once again fear the American people, and that scares the holy shit out of them, and they should be scared. Because
and by the way, that's what scares them about Trump.
There's a generation of us that know it. There's a generation of us who aren't afraid to bring it in a different way, in a different perspective, and now we have a bullhorn to shout over the left that makes our voice amplified in Donald Trump.
Sonny, you have a bullhorn to yell over the left, right, and center every day.
Yeah, but you know what?
Notice I introduced you as being loud.
You know what? Yeah, I'm glad she is loud, because so is Trump in his way, because that's what it takes. If you are not dramatic and loud, or if you don't have searing rhetoric, you cannot cut through this filter. And that's what frustrates the left and the establishment and the elites, is that Trump has shredded their filter. He has decimated their ability to control dialogue. And
before
that is what they don't like.
Before he built the wall, he broke down the progressive wall.
That's right. And I think he's got the opportunity to do that. And by the way, just quickly on education, forgive me for digressing, but the worst example of socialism in this country is the K-12 school system that we have, especially in the largest cities. We don't have not one urban school system that is performing anything close to acceptably in terms of dropout rates, graduation rates, international testing standards. Not one. The closest, I think, is Boston, and they spend $24,000 a head, you know, which is nearly double the national
Or look at where I am here in D.C. This is the nation's capital. It just came out that you have to make $120,000 a year to have a two-bedroom apartment, and you still don't get a decent school. D.C., I saw, according to a study, ranks 48, I think, in the country. That is insane. I mean, there's so much money here and whatnot, and there are absolutely no decent schools.
We're spending $700 billion a year on this god-awful government-controlled K through 12 super.
I'm all for abolishing the public school system, in my opinion.
The way I put it is that government should fund schools but not run schools. And that tax money, if you put $11,000, $12,000, $14,000 a year per child in the hands of a parent, I assure you that Harlem Children's Zone, Success Academies, KIPP Academies,
preparatory schools.
There are so many examples of absolutely stellar schools that are in many cases they're receiving government funds because they're operating charter schools. Sometimes they're private, but it is an outrage, and we're perpetuating the vestiges of slavery and Jim Crow and the segregation conspiracy that occurred until well after the Civil Rights Bill was passed in 1964.
I agree.
We're perpetuating it. The worst vestiges of it are these schools, and then we wonder why these kids aren't turning out okay. It's insanity. It's insanity writ large.
I agree. So look, guys, I admit I'm like the absolute worst timekeeper. But thank you. This is another episode of Top Glitch Radio, sponsored by a parent company, VM Free Media, your source for all your communication and PR needs. I am your host, whether you like it or not, Giovanni Russo, the media mogul. We air every Sunday live at 3 p.m. Eastern. I want to thank our guest, Sonny Johnson. It only took, I'm not going to say how long I've had my show, for Sonny to come
on. I'm like, what's up?
Yeah,
you know,
Sonny said
her feelings were starting to get hurt.
Sonny said that she felt like she was a girlfriend that was kept a secret in the closet. I promise if I get a girlfriend, I will let you know.
As if that was even possible.
I want
to
be the first to
know. Sonny is the host of the Did She Say That show on Breitbart and iTunes. You can also catch me there weekly with my segment. And I'd like to thank Mr. Lee Speakerman, president of Speakerman Media. You can follow him on Twitter at, I'm going to spell this correctly, at Speakerman, S-P-I-E-C-K-E-R-M-A-N. Tell me I got
it. It's phonetically correct. It just has to be there. I before E, except after C, you know, it's a long E.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's 11 letters.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for being on, sir. And make sure you go to popglitch.com for the latest in celebrity news.
It's been a joy.